a couple things. First of all, after Kindlina kind of begins, I'll put out some more chairs, so it's not, I would imagine a couple more people might come, but there's just a couple things I wanted to say. First of all, this session will probably run over like less than 5 minutes or around 5 minutes, because we're going to be covering about 50 pages worth of material, so this is actually the longest one, so it'll probably end up being just slightly over an hour and a half, so just so you know. Also, I hope you noticed from the flyer that this is not a study. This is a work group. The difference between a study and a work group is that a study is about teaching and learning, and it's about information. And there's an occasional reference to, you know, encouragement of doing the work. But basically, it's about teaching and learning and about information. This is a work group, so hopefully most, if not all of you, are going to participate by taking the actions of all of the steps as we go through these 5 weeks. So please keep that in mind. This is about participation, and it's about taking the actions to have an experience, a new experience with the process. Whether you did it 3 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, we're encouraging people to go through the process again as a group. This might seem a little blunt, but we're not here to help you sound better at meetings. We're here to facilitate an experience with the full process of the 12 steps to transform many, if not all, of the aspects of your life for the better. So just, if you could, please keep that in mind. How we'd like to begin is with something that's referred to as a set-aside prayer. So if you could perhaps get settled, and I'd like to read the set-aside prayer, which is sort of a way of getting into the process that we're about to begin. So if we could just settle down and just be quiet for a few seconds, I'd like to read this prayer. Also, if you haven't gotten them, there's handouts in the back. We'll be referring to them occasionally, so you'll need to have one. Okay, so this is the set-aside prayer. Dear God, please set aside anything we think we know about ourselves, about our disease, about the big book, the 12 steps, the fellowship, the spiritual terms, and especially you, God, so that we may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please help us see the truth. Amen.
We would now like to take a trip back in time. It's the fall of 1946. You have a drinking problem, and you telephone Alcoholics Anonymous for help. AA responds by sending two people out to see you. The ex-problem drinkers talk about their personal experiences with alcohol, their understanding of alcoholism, and how they found a way out. They tell you that, as part of their recovery, they try to be of service to others. After listening to their stories and explanations, you agree to be hospitalized. They take you to a local hospital where you're withdrawn from alcohol. The process takes 3 days. During this period of time, you are visited by many of the members of the local AA group. Upon your release, you're assigned a sponsor whose responsibility it is to accompany you to the Alcoholics Anonymous beginners meetings. You take all 12 steps in about 1 month. Your life changes, you never drink again. Sounds incredibly simple, isn't it? Well, it was simple, and it worked. AA's remarkable recovery rate during the 40s was due in large part to these beginners' meetings, and for many thousands of alcoholics, they provided the foundation for a spiritual way of life, which was essential for long-term contented sobriety. So let's imagine it's 8 o'clock on a weeknight in a Midwest city. You're sitting at a table in the meeting room of a local church. You have a copy of the book titled Alcoholics Anonymous with you, along with a pencil and paper. The first of the 5.5-hour sessions is about to start. This AA meeting is being hosted by one of the local groups. As leaders, we are members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have taken the steps and have sponsored other alcoholics through them. Welcome to the first of 5.5-hour AA meetings that will change your life. During the next several weeks, you will learn how to recover from afflictions of alcoholism by taking the 12 steps as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA has found an answer to this insidious illness. As members of AA, we are here this morning to share AA's solution with you, a spiritually based plan of action that will remove your compulsion to drink and provide you with a new way of contented living without alcohol. Our names are Lena,
And Bill.
And we are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We lead these meetings to help ensure our own sobriety. We receive no payment for the service. Our reward is to watch people recover and to see them help others. So that we can complete each session within an hour and a half and will provide ample time for questions, we request that you write down anything that you do not understand or need clarified and save it until the end of the session. We will answer questions at that time. The Big Book is basically the only book we will discuss during this meeting, except for an occasional reference to 12 and 12 or a newsletter article. We will do our best to keep our opinions out of these discussions. We are here to pass on the AA program as written and practiced by the early members. We are not here to present our interpretation of the program.
In order for the process to work, newcomers need to be matched up with those AA members who are willing to sponsor them through the 5 weekly sessions that we're going to have here. In addition, each person working the steps with us and those working with them are asked to make a commitment of attending all 5 meetings. Even if just one meeting of these sessions is not attended, a large part of the process is missed. So let's get started. First, will the newcomers and those interested in working the steps with us please stand? Now, these are the people who are here to take the 12 steps of AA during these 5 1.5-hour sessions. Now, with those of you who do not have sponsors who are familiar with the Big Book here with you, please remain standing. Thank you.
Let's start this session by turning to Roman numeral page 13, XIII. At the top of the page 13, which is XIII. Which is the foreword to the first edition, we find. XIII, Roman numeral 13. You can hear me? Roman numeral 13, XIII. We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary. We think this account of our experiences will help everyone to better understand the alcoholic. Many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person, and besides, we are sure that our way of living has advantages for all. With all the many different fellowships in this world today that use the 12-step format, the last line certainly has come true. Also, in the paragraph we just read, the Big Book authors immediately tell us that the purpose of this book is to show us how to recover from alcoholism. This is a revolutionary statement because until this book was written, there was no hope for alcoholics, and that hasn't changed since 1939. Now, anyone who is willing to follow the directions they have provided can recover. We know that the words recover or recovered are not necessarily popular words in AA today. However, these words are used throughout our literature. For a new person in AA, and perhaps for those who do not know, what does the word recovered mean? Medically speaking, the word recovered means that the symptoms of the disease has been removed. And the word cured means that the disease has been removed. So Bill Wilson is using the correct word here. We are not cured of the disease of alcoholism, but we can be recovered from all of its symptoms. The Big Book also gives what we can be considered as our definition for the word recovered, beginning at the bottom page of the bottom of page 84. So if you flip to page 84, these are known as 10-step promises, and they're also often used as a definition of what the book means recovered, you know, the separation from alcohol promises. And we've ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time, sanity. which means seeing the truth about the first drink, will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally, and we'll find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. This is the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither we are avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It doesn't exist for us. We have recovered. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. Now, here's a warning. That is how we react so long as, or if, we keep in fit spiritual condition. Please now turn back to the beginning of the book, Roman numeral page 20, or XX. This is from the foreword to the second edition, which was written in 1955, 16 years after the Big Book was published. Five lines down from the top of page XX, it says, of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Remember that this was written 20 years after AA began. This is saying that all those who came to AA and went through this process, 75% eventually got sober. Now let us remember that this is long before there was a lot of meetings, so it was impossible for people to get sober on the fellowship. They needed to get sober on the program. They applied these steps to their life, they had a spiritual awakening or spiritual experience, and they didn't find it necessary to drink from that point on. Maybe after these next 5 weeks, we can apply these principles to our life, get some results, and carry this simple message into our fellowship, and then maybe AA as a whole will again have a 75% rate of recovery like they did back then.
Let's begin with our discussion of step one. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Surrender is essential in order to recover from alcoholism. I'm sorry, we're not going to answer any questions until the end. We're not in the book. We're not in the book right now. Yeah, when we're in the book, we'll let you know. So, and then if you're reading and then all of a sudden you don't see where we are, then we're just commentary. So sorry about that. Also, this session, we bounce around a little bit more than we usually do. Pretty much the next four sessions, we'll be just kind of going through as a flow, but what we're trying to do is present certain pieces of information, so the most effective way to do that is to kind of stay with the information, so we're going to be bouncing around because we're trying to cover 51 pages, so it's a lot of material, so sorry for the confusion. The Big Book devotes 51 pages to the first part of the surrender process, which is to admit that we have a problem that we cannot help ourselves with. The authors begin by describing the physical, mental, and spiritual symptoms of alcoholism. Later, they ask us to acknowledge that we are alcoholics. Before we can do this, we need to know what the difference is between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. Much of the section called The Doctor's Opinion is based on two letters written by Dr. William D. Silkworth, a physician at Towns Hospital in New York City. In the late 1930s, very little was known about alcoholism, but what Dr. Silkworth wrote then is still relevant today. Please turn to Roman numeral page 5, or V. You will need to know what edition of the Big Book you have, and this is where the table of contents at the beginning of the book can be found. So on Roman numeral page 5, or V, you will find the beginning of the book's chapter names. It begins with a preface and the first few forewords followed by the doctor's opinion. If your book contains a foreword to the fourth edition, then you have a fourth edition Big Book. If your book does not have a foreword to the fourth edition, you have a third edition Big Book. This is important to know as we go through tonight's session because the beginning Roman numerals part, the fourth edition pages are different than the third edition pages, so you'll need to know which edition you have, so please keep that in mind. Now please turn to Roman numeral page 23, or XXIII in the third edition, or page 25, XXV in the fourth edition. Dr. Silkworth describes how Bill Wilson, one of the co-founders of AA, recovered from alcoholism. Bill had once been a well-respected Wall Street stock analyst, but had lost everything due to his drinking. Again, page XXIII in the third edition, or XXV in the fourth edition, in the middle of the page. In late 1934, if we could shut our phones off, please. Thank you. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise to still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of the type with whom other methods have failed utterly. And then now we're going to go into the commentary. For several years prior to 1934, Dr. Silkworth had been treating alcoholics at Towns Hospital with very little success. Then, during his third trip to the hospital, Bill Wilson discovered the spiritual solution to alcoholism, which he helped develop into the AA program. One of the things Bill learned while in Towns Hospital was that he had to work with other alcoholics in order to stay sober himself. He also learned that alcoholism was a physical and spiritual illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. On Roman numeral page 24, which is XXIV in the third edition, or 26 XXVI in the fourth edition, the authors confirmed that Dr. Silkworth was well aware of the spiritual aspects of alcoholism. Again, page XXIV in the third, or XXVI in the fourth, about a quarter of the way down the page, it says the following. The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe, that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It does not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we are maladjusted to life, that we are in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us, and I know I can relate to that. But we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out the physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinions to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. Now, please notice that in that paragraph, it mentions the word allergy at the beginning of the last paragraph I just read. This word can be misunderstood, since the only experience most of us have with allergies is that some substance brings about watery eyes, a rash, sneezing, swelling, or some other physical reaction. For almost all of us, these kinds of reactions at drinking alcohol did not happen. So what is Dr. Silkworth talking about here? The definition for the word allergy is an abnormal reaction to any food, liquor, liquid, or substance. So let's look at a normal reaction to alcohol. Alcohol is a poison. The normal reaction to alcohol is to have one or two drinks and not go any further. But our reaction is much different. We have one or two drinks just to get started. Once an alcoholic starts drinking, because of the unique way it's processed in our body, we set off a craving where we want more alcohol. This is an allergy or abnormal reaction to alcohol, because about 9 out of 10 people don't get that once they start drinking. So an alcoholic cannot always safely predict how much they are going to drink, and a non-alcoholic can always predict how much they're going to drink.
Please turn to the first full paragraph on page XXVI in the third edition, or XXVIII in the fourth edition, where the big book talks about the allergy again. We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class. They're talking about alcoholics, this class of alcoholics, and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Well, I drank for the first time when I was 13, and I drank hard liquor, and I started drinking, and I experienced certain nice feelings. And even though I started losing control, I started getting nauseous, even though the floor started moving under my feet, I continued drinking until I passed out. So just looking at that particular experience and how I drank after that, I know that the allergy was with me the first time, like from the get-go, some people develop allergy over time. And, you know, what we're trying to do right now is, you know, for you to go back into your experience and see, can I identify with this? Can I identify with, when I put alcohol in my body, I can't control the amount that I will consume.
So in other words, whenever it says, this is the inexperience of an alcoholic, ask yourself if this is your experience, because this is a self-diagnosed disease.
These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. Frothy, which means long-winded, light, insignificant, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves, if they are to recreate their life, and that's the promise. Toward the bottom of Roman numeral page 28 in the third edition, which is XXVIII, or Roman numeral page 30 in the fourth edition, XXX, Dr. Silkworth tells us that because of this abnormal reaction to alcohol, we must refrain from drinking. Page XXVIII in the third edition, or XXX in the fourth edition, last full paragraph. All these, and they're talking about different drinking, different types of alcoholics, and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated, which means removed. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Well, abstinence might work if alcoholism was only a physical illness, but Dr. Silkworth found that alcoholism has a mental component as well. In addition to an abnormal physical reaction, we also have a mental obsession. When we pick up a drink, our mind does not tell us that what we are about to do is harmful, even as alcohol is bringing us closer and closer to death. No matter how much we may want to stop, if we do not seek a spiritual solution, sooner or later we will return to drinking. Dr. Silkworth describes this mental obsession in his letter on Roman numeral page 26, XXVI, in the third edition, or XXVIII in the fourth edition. So we're going a little bit back here. Please keep in mind that Dr. Silkworth is talking about alcoholics here in the last paragraph when he writes at the bottom. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it's injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others take with impunity, which means freedom from problems. After they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over and over and over and over again, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of this recovery. What's interesting about this paragraph is that it contains sort of all three parts of the disease of alcoholism. You know, the first reference to what we call the spiritual malady, and Bill will be talking more about it, is described in this paragraph. We are restless, irritable, and discontented. That's one of the definitions of untreated alcoholism, if you will, or spiritual malady, that state of us being disconnected from the power of God. you know, running our life on our will. And for as long as we are having that condition, our mind will bring us to what gives us ease and comfort, and that's the mental component of our disease, the mental obsession. And once we picked up the drink, the phenomenon of craving developed, and that's, you know, that's how the cycle continues over and over and over again. And it's being fueled by the spiritual malady. The underlying, you know, the underlying problem for us is really the spiritual, and it's the first time in the book that it's being mentioned here. In case you didn't know, the word psychic change, right? It talks about psychic change. Means of or pertaining to the human mind, soul, or spirit. So a prominent doctor, Dr. Silkworth, in the field of alcoholism, with 9 years of experience with alcoholics at the time when this book was written, tells us that the medical community cannot do anything for us. Our only hope is what Dr. Silkworth calls an entire psychic change, otherwise known as the spiritual awakening.
The other part of the physical difference between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic is that alcohol does something for the alcoholic that it doesn't do for the non-alcoholic. If you were to ask a non-alcoholic what happens when they drink alcohol, they would tell you that they get something like an out-of-control, beginning of a nauseating, slightly tipsy, I don't like this, so I don't want any more kind of a feeling. I know I can't relate to that. That's why they stop after a few and then go home to their husband or wives. And when the alcoholic puts alcohol into their body, they get an in-control, ease and inner comfort, let's get up and go into town, I like this, so I want more kind of a feeling. So that's why a non-alcoholic will say, I don't want another drink because I'm starting to feel the first one. Then we look at them funny because we like what it's doing for us, and that's why we're going for more. They are having a completely different experience than we are having. Then, because of the way we alcoholics deal with other people, with our emotions, and with life, we have a lot of inner turmoil and anxiety going on. Since we can't seem to bring about this relief, ease, and inner comfort on our own, we turn to alcohol again and again because alcohol does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. So it's important to see that if you're an alcoholic, alcohol is not your problem. It's your solution to your problem. We don't see the truth about the problems that alcohol causes us, because we're only thinking about the relief that comes when we drink. That's why the AA program of working the steps is more than just not drinking. They're about finding a comfortable way of life that doesn't include needing alcohol. There's a big difference between just not drinking and not drinking and being happy about it. So if you cannot handle drinking and you cannot handle not drinking, then AA is for you. Also included in this last paragraph at the bottom of page XXVI or XXVIII in the fourth edition is a mention of another aspect of alcoholism. It is the unmanageability mentioned in step one. It is sometimes called the spiritual malady or untreated alcoholism or the mental state that precedes the first drink or the root of our problem. The spiritual malady or spiritual illness, which is the result of being spiritually blocked off by self-centered fear, exists for us as long as we are not seeking and growing toward a spiritual solution, whether we are drinking or not. The Big Book gives us many descriptions of the inner condition that occurs if an alcoholic does not deal with this spiritual malady or this spiritual block. They can be found in your handout, this actually isn't in your handout packet, but I'm not going to tell you where this is in the book because I have to list a whole lot of examples, so just listen and ask yourself if you can relate to any of this, because if you're currently experiencing this, you may be closer to your next drink than you realize. Now, Dr. Silkworth just mentioned their inner state as being restless, which means having anxiety and a sense that something's missing, irritable, which means easily annoyed, and I don't know about you, but irritable was my middle name for about 35 years, easily annoyed. And discontented, which means never satisfied. Here are a few more references in the Big Book that can describe how this spiritual malady, you know, what it looks like and how it feels. In the chapter called More About Alcoholism, the Big Book describes it as nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, and the like. In the next chapter, We Agnostics, it also describes the inner unmanageability as having trouble with personal relationships, not being able to control their emotional nature, being a prey to misery and depression, not being able to make a living, which includes not being able to make a successful life, having a feeling of uselessness, being full of fear, being unhappy, and not seeming to be of real help to other people. In the sixth chapter, Into Action refers to the spiritual malady in this way. Most people are like More than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart that he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he is revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As far as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. They're talking about secrets here. As far as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension, and that makes for or leads back to more drinking. Later in the same chapter, it talks about the spiritual block as follows. The alcoholic is like a tornado roaring through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted, selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil. Now, there are other statements in the Big Book that refer to the spiritual malady or the unmanageability or the spiritual block mentioned in step one, but those we have just read are some of the better ones. Please keep in mind that this happens even if we are not currently drinking. If these conditions generally describe your current inner experience, please consider the fact that you may be suffering from untreated alcoholism whether you're drinking or not. You may be headed toward your next drink, and you may be closer to a relapse than you think you are. It doesn't matter so much how long it's been since your last drink. What matters more is how close am I to my next drink. It's something to think about. No, it's not in there. Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, yeah. So you know, in your packet toward the end, there's something that's called the step one unmanageability exercise. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily look at it now. If anything, I'd almost prefer you not look at it now because you'll get very distracted when you look at it. Because this unmanageability exercise takes most of the references in the Big Book that refer to the spiritual malady and then creates an exercise around it that you'll be doing over the next week when you go home before next session. So just to let you know, there is an exercise in your handout packet that talks about this specifically and gives you an exercise so you can identify how are you doing spiritually currently. Now, the book continues in the first full paragraph on page XXVIII in the third edition, or XXIX in the fourth edition, and this paragraph offers some hope. Dr. Spokeworth continues by saying, it's the same page you were on, and it's the first full paragraph, or maybe it's the next page, it's XXIV in the fourth edition. It says, on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, what was that?
XXIX.
Yeah, I'm sorry, XXIX. In the fourth edition. Right. On the other hand, as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change, otherwise known as a spiritual awakening, has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despairs of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required follow a few simple rules, and the few simple rules are all of the 12 steps.
Okay, let's move on to chapter 1, which is Bill's story. And from this part of the book, the page numbers match. It's page number 1.
So yeah, the rest of this part is that the page numbers are the same for both editions.
In this chapter, we'll learn more about physical and mental aspects of alcoholism, and also more about the spiritual solution. As we mentioned earlier, Bill is the New York stock analyst and is one of our co-founders. Some people have difficulty identifying with Bill's story because he was such a low-bottom, hopeless alcoholic. Here, as elsewhere in the book, we ask that you look for similarities rather than differences. You know, just like when we are at an AA speaker meeting, we would see where we can relate to the way the speaker thought, felt, or drank long after alcohol has become a problem. In this way, we are able to identify rather than compare. Bill's story consists of 16 pages, broken down into two parts. The first 8 pages, Bill writes about what it was like, and he talks a lot about the progressive nature of his drinking. In a few short years, he loses everything. He becomes an unemployed, hopeless drunk. Then, in the second 8 pages of Bill's story, he talks about what happened, meaning how God entered his life, and what he's like now, how he's been transformed as a, by that power. Please turn to regular page 8, where Bill has a moment of clarity. He realizes alcohol is his master. He's licked defeated. Page 8, paragraph 1. This is where Bill reaches his conclusion of step 1. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. However, Bill cannot stop drinking on this admission alone. So he continues drinking, and in late November 1934, he's visited by an old school friend, Abby C. Bill is drunk. Abby has been sober for several months. When Bill asks Abby how he stopped drinking, Abby tells him in the middle of page 9, I've got religion. Bill is shocked, but he lets Abby continue because, as he writes, my gin would last longer than his preaching. Obviously, he's very skeptical about Abby's solution. Abby explains to Bill that he has found a group of people who rely upon a power greater than themselves and who try to live their lives based on spiritual principles. In 1934, this organization was called the Oxford Group. In 1938, it became, it changed its name to Moral Rearmament, or MRA. And in a few years ago, they changed their name to Initiatives for Change, but they still exist. That group still exists today. The Oxford Group is a life-changing fellowship which utilizes six spiritual tenets or principles. These tenets can be found on page 292 in the third edition and 263 in the fourth edition. So please turn there now. It's 292 in the third edition and 263 in the fourth edition. The six tenets of the Oxford Group are as follows. 1, complete deflation, which became our first step. 2, dependence and guidance from a higher power, which became our steps 2, 3, 6, 7, and 11. Moral inventory, which became our fourth and tenth steps. Confession, which became our fifth step. Restitution, which became our steps 8, 9. And continued work with others, which became our step 12.
Please turn back to page 12. Abby provides Bill with the Oxford Group solution for the first time. Or for the first time, Bill learns about how he can move toward having what Dr. Silkworth called an entire psychic change by turning his will and his life over to God as he of his understanding. In the middle of the page, Bill takes step 2. Again, page 12, paragraph 4. It says, it was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Soon after Ebby's visit, Bill checks into Towns Hospital. There, under the direction of Dr. Silkworth, Bill is physically withdrawn from alcohol for the third time that year. While in the hospital, Bill applies the Oxford Group's six tenets or spiritual activities, which later became the 12 steps, and he never drinks again. On page 13, in the second paragraph, Bill experiences the Oxford Group tenet of dependence on a higher power. In other words, here is where Bill takes what later became steps 2 and 3. Again, page 13, paragraph 2. There I humbly offered myself to God, as I then understood him, to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and protection. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. The next line mentions the Oxford Group tenet of moral inventory, which is Bill's step 4. It's followed by what later became steps 6 and 7. It says, I ruthlessly faced my sins, that's step 4. I became willing to have my newfound friends, and he's using a capital F here, so he's talking about God, take them away root and branch. I have not had a drink since. When Bill wrote, I ruthlessly faced my sins, he is using an Oxford Group term. According to the Oxford Group, the definition for the word sin is anything that blocks us off from God and others. Bill then works the tenet of confession. He becomes willing to go through with the tenet of restitution. These actions later became steps 5, 8, and 9. So the book continues. My schoolmate visited me, Ebi returns, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of people I had hurt toward and toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed an entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Now, I always like that description a whole lot better than the word amends, because some people in our fellowship think the word amends just means to apologize. But how it's describing it there is, I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Now, that might include an apology, but it's a whole lot more than just saying we're sorry. Bless you. Bless you. In the next paragraph, Bill practices the Oxford Group tenet of dependence and guidance from a higher power. In other words, Bill begins to do steps, what later became steps 10 and 11. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Bless you. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure.
The book continues, next paragraph. My friends promised, and these are our promises too, when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a new way of living which answers all my problems. Believe in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Not just suggestions, but requirements. Simple but not easy, the price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. At the bottom of page 14, Ebi explains the necessity of the last tenet, which is continued work with others. This part of step 12 begins in the last paragraph, where Bill writes, my friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. Now, the next line might be one of the most important lines in the whole book, so please note it. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he didn't work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die, then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it's just like that. Bill takes the actions prescribed by the Oxford Group and has a sudden transforming experience. He has the entire psychic change that Dr. Silkworth talks about in The Doctor's Opinion. In the second paragraph on page 14, Bill describes his spiritual awakening. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Bill's life drastically changed. He never drinks alcohol again as the result of taking certain actions. And now please turn to page 17, which is the beginning of the next chapter called There Is a Solution. The book says, the feeling of having shared in a common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution, which is the second element. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Where we get the feeling of having shared in the common peril is in the fellowship of AA. But the book is warning us that getting involved in just the fellowship is not enough. It's just one part of our solution. There are two parts to AA's solution to alcoholism. And fellowship, the fellowship, one, and the program, which are the 12 steps. And we need to be involved in both parts. The book continues. Please turn to the next page. The fourth paragraph on page 18 says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, meaning had a spiritual awakening, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, which is another way of saying that he's worked the steps, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. The next paragraph gives a pretty good description of what to look for in a sponsor. That the man who is making the approach has had the same difficulty, that he obviously knows what he's talking about, that his whole deportment, which means behavior and attitude, shouts at the new prospect that he's a man with a real answer, that he has no attitude of holier-than-thou, nothing whatever except the sincere desire to be helpful, that there are no fees to pay, no axes to grind, no people to please, no lectures to be endured. These are the conditions we have found most effective. The man had found a solution, and I can see it in his eyes. After such an approach, many take up their beds and walk again.
Please turn to page 22, where the authors make an important point about the mental aspect of alcoholism. Page 22, the last paragraph. It says the following. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other people. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind rather than the body. So it's important to identify by asking yourself if you can relate to the physical feature of alcoholism by seeing if your drinking career reflects the inability to predict how much you're going to drink once you start. But you don't have to worry about that part of alcoholism if you never put the alcohol in your body in the first place. So the main problem of the alcoholic centers in their mind and in their spiritual condition because their spiritual condition controls their minds. Please turn to page 24. Starting at the top of the page, the authors say the following. So, top of page 24. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into the state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. This tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it was suspected. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times, now not all the time, but at certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation we've been a week or a month ago, and in some cases even a day or a few hours ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter or prevent us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy, which means vague, and readily supplanted or replaced with the old threadbare, which means worn out, idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense which keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. You may have noticed that the first line on this page says, the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. Although a desire to stop drinking is the only requirement for AA membership, which simply means that you are allowed to sit at a closed meeting, this desire alone is not enough to bring about permanent recovery. The last paragraph on this page says that when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid and unless locked up may die or go permanently insane. So again, we are beyond human aid. It also says in the ABCs at the end of how it works that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Although a sponsor in the fellowship is very important, they are still forms of human aid and they are not enough to bring about permanent recovery from alcoholism. Please turn to page 30. The Big Book authors give us more about how this mental obsession kills so many of us. Again, starting at the top of page 30, it says, "Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily or mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we can drink like other people." So again, they're describing an alcoholic there. Ask yourself if your drinking career has shown that you've done this. The book continues, "The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession or lie of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion or lie is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death." Now, it's almost humorous that the big book says the idea that somehow we will control and enjoy our drinking is the great obsession. If I am an alcoholic, there were times when I could do one or the other, but never both. There were times when I was controlling my drinking, but I was not enjoying it. And there were times when I was enjoying my drinking, but these times could not be described as having control. So if I am an alcoholic, the times of controlling and enjoying my drinking are long gone.
The book further speaks talks about mental obsession starting on page 34. And continuing through the end of the chapter, by stating again and again that no matter how strong our willpower or our conviction, at certain times we're unable to stay away from that first drink. Page 34, paragraph 2. "For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Whether such a person can quit upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever. Yet, we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish." That's a great description of powerlessness. The book continues, "How then shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render an even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux or the most important point of the problem. Please keep this statement in mind as we go through the rest of this chapter. The examples given in the next few pages are there to show the mental state prior to drinking." The book continues, What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into the saloon. Why does he, and what is he thinking? Our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everyone likes him. He is an intelligent man, normal as far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. Right? The externals look okay, but there is something that's brewing inside. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent when intoxicated that he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we know of alcoholism. So what we know about alcoholism, they told him about the first step, the physical allergy and the craving, which is operative if once we take a drink, and the mental obsession that ensures that we'll return to drinking, even when we stop. And the answer we had found, they told him about steps 2 through 12. He made a beginning, so he started working only some of the steps. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And the way we enlarge our spiritual lives is by continuing work with all the steps on a daily basis, going to meetings and helping others. The big book says that the third step is only a beginning, So the gentleman in this story probably did the first three steps, but then he did not go on with the rest of the program. Also, it's been said that every member of AA who has ever relapsed did so because of that last sentence. They failed to enlarge their spiritual life. So please stay aware of this as time passes in your own recovery. The book continues. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of these occasions, we worked with him, reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was an alcoholic and in a serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had deep affection. Yet, he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. I came to work on Tuesday morning, wondering what he was doing on Monday. I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. He felt irritated. It means to me that he might have had a resentment, not even realized or understood. I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. A little bit of an altercation, sounds to me. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I really like how most of these stories are written. Some of the AA members refer to it as a setup and then an ambush. You know, the circumstances create this. You know. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going in it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at a table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Now please pay attention here because of the curly writing. It's important. Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind, a genius thought crossed my mind, that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. That started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea or the lie that he could take the whiskey if only he mixed it with milk.
So again, they're describing the experience of an alcoholic. Ask yourself if you can relate to experiences like this. The book continues. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme case. For us, it is not far-fetched. For this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that, parallel with our sound reasoning, there inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea went out. Next day, we would ask ourselves, in all earnestness and sincerity, how it could have happened. In some circumstances, we have gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified, and again, this is when we're spiritually blocked, justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we are obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in the light of what always happened. We now see that when we begin to drink deliberately instead of casually, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. Now let's go back to the top of this page and notice some of the ways the book describes the mental obsession, because the way Bill writes, he likes saying the same thing using different words over and over again. Like I said, go back to the top of the page where he describes the mental obsession. In the first line, he calls it the foolish idea. The fourth line down, he calls it plain insanity. Then a few words later, he calls it the lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. Then six lines later, the curious mental phenomenon. Two lines after that, some insanely trivial excuse. Two lines later, he calls it the insane idea. Seven lines after that, our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient. And then two lines later, he calls it, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences might be. So again, this is a good example of you know, Bill just using different words to describe the same thing. You know, if he doesn't get you the first time, maybe he gets you the third time, but he just kind of says the same thing over and over again until it sinks in. The big book continues on the bottom of page 37. Our behavior is, and I love this example, our behavior is as absurd or incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as that of an individual for a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. And this guy's pretty weird because he doesn't even run or walk in front of fast-moving vehicles. Well, he skips in front of them. You know? He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he is slightly injured several times in succession. You would expect him, if he were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he is hit again, and this time, he has a fractured skull. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley breaks his arm. He tells you he has decided to stop the jaywalking for good, but in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. You know, how many times do we say to people that, you know, I'm not going to drink anymore? On through the years, his conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the street altogether. So he's basically saying, you know, I'm going to stop or I'm going to moderate. You know, I'm going to be careful or I'm going to keep off the street completely. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce and he is held up to ridicule. He tries every known means of the jaywalking to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. Again, we get the idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? You may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit that if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, we find, or where alcohol had been involved, we have been strangely insane. And this is kind of funny because he's basically saying that for insane people, we're even strange. You know, we're strangely insane. We're not just insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Some of you are thinking, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admit we have some of these symptoms. We have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to. For we understand ourselves so well after what you have told us that such things cannot happen again. So basically they're saying we're only a little alcoholic, but our life is manageable. We have not lost everything in life to drinking, and we certainly do not intend to. Thanks for the information. You know, in other words, I've heard this at meetings in talking with people. You know what I mean? In different words, that's pretty much exactly what I've heard often. That may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are unable to stop, and that's because they don't have the mental obsession, or moderate, because they don't have the allergy, the craving for more once they drink, because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and re-emphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers as it has been revealed to us at our bitter experience. Let us take another example. And you'll notice in this example, he makes the statement, I'm only a little alcoholic, but my life is manageable.
Well, this is Fred's example. This is one of those high-bottom examples. And it's interesting, when I went through this work for the first time, I made a note for myself that it's important for me, that it's relevant for me because it's high-bottom, so I considered myself high-bottom. And then I'm reading, his income is good, I didn't have any of it. He had a fine home, I didn't have a home. He's happily married, I wasn't married. And the father of promising children of college age, I didn't have any children of any age. He has such, it's just like, it's so funny, like more will get revealed, you know. The more we do this work, the more we get to see. So it's Fred's story. He is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good, he has a fine home, is happily married, and the father of promising children of college age. He is so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it's Fred. To all appearances, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. To all appearances, note, right? It's just talking about the external. That's how things look. Yet he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he came to the hospital to rest his nerves. You know how it is. Detoxes and rehabs are filled with nerve resters. The doctor intimated or suggested strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind, so he's trying to use his willpower, to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he couldn't do so, in spite of his character and standing. And, you know, I like to think sometimes of mental obsession as a kind of learning disability. You know, we can be very successful in all our affairs in life, but when it comes to alcohol, when it comes to seeing the truth about the first drink, I was just not capable of learning in that area. So it never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so, in spite of his character and standing. Friend would not believe himself an alcoholic, so he never took the first step, so there is no need for the rest of the steps, much less accept a spiritual remedy for his problem. So if you don't take step one, there is no need for steps 2 through 12. We told him about alcoholism. Notice the 12-step work, as it did back then, how he was approached and how he was assisted in his process. Again, they told him about the mental obsession and they told him about the allergy of the body. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience, plus the knowledge he had acquired, would keep him sober the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated that he was anxious to see us. The story he told us is most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, but I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I somewhat appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity which precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I've learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I was every right to be confident that it would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. Again, self-will and self-knowledge is not enough if you're a real alcoholic. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time, all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard work of a simple matter. One day, I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I'd been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Fine. Really means nothing. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Feeling fabulous. The interesting thing about what leads up to Fred's relapse is that he was neither hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, what the fellowship calls halt. None of this applies here. If you remember in the Jim story earlier, Jim was not having an up day. You know, he was having a little bit of resentment, and he had a little bit of altercation with the boss. But here, it's none of these things are present. So Fred is having a really good day. I went to my hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. Now there is a curly writing again. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. I ordered a cocktail and my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me. Mm-hmm. You see, not just nice, it struck me because he set out a craving. It struck me a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York, of finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I had and did. Sounds like a blackout. Then came the hospital with its unbearable mental and physical suffering. As soon as I regained my ability to think...
I love that.
I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against that first rank. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come and I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink.
You notice the 12-step work there. You know, the AAs planted the seed and let them know, okay, well, you know, maybe you're not an alcoholic, but just to let you know, this is what's going to happen if you are an alcoholic. And then it did happen to him, and now he could finally make that conclusion.
Well, just that did happen, and more. For what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. Again, they're describing the mental obsession. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow.
Now, again, notice the 12-step work here. It says, two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned, which I didn't like so much.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. And then asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic and if I was really licked this time. Now, you notice in the past, they didn't so much get into explaining the solution to him because he didn't feel he had a problem, so he didn't need to be explained the solution. So now they started from the beginning again. They said, do you think you're an alcoholic now? Are you licked? Are you done? And then after he said yes, then they started to outline the spiritual solution. And asked me if I thought myself an alcoholic if I was really licked this time. I had to concede both propositions, so he finally takes step one. They piled on me heaps of medical evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozen. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Now, what's also interesting is something that's important in regard to 12-step work is, if you excuse the expression, hammering the hopelessness. We need to hammer the hopelessness. We need to. That was one of the things. If you ever read AA Comes of Age or Dr. Bob and the Old Timers, he talks about that the one thing that really hit him the most when Bill came to visit, or when Bill and Bob met, was that Bill just hammered the hopelessness. And the more and more that he did that, the more and more Bob got the picture of, I really am hopeless, that I can't do this on my own. And I now see that, and someone sharing with me about how they were unable to do it, and they did find a solution, and they did find an answer, which became our 12 steps, and that we can move in that direction if we feel as hopeless as the, what AA describes as hopelessness, that the powerlessness and unmanageability. Then he outlined a spiritual answer and program of action that 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their propositions were not intellectually hard to swallow. And this is when he kind of starts getting into step two. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant that I had to throw out several lifelong conceptions out the window. The holding on to old ideas and all that stuff, half measures, thinking we can do it on our own, those kind of old ideas we have to throw out the window. That was not easy, but the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, which you'll see next week is describing step three, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as abnormal was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems, not just my alcohol problem, but all my problems. They've said that a couple times tonight, or today, this morning. I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying, and I hope more useful than the life I have lived before. My old manner of living was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back, even if I could. And the only way that this gentleman could have experienced that is if he did the rest of the steps. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they can really commence to solve their problems. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusion. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As the two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless apart from divine help. Had you offered yourselves as patients to this hospital, I would not have taken you if I could have been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in such cases as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. And once more, so he's going to give us another review. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times, not all the time, but at certain times, has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power. So now you've been given a few examples of the fact that because of the way we selfishly perceive and live our life, we create a spiritually blocked off condition for ourselves where we need to seek relief or escape from inner turmoil, discomfort, and unmanageability. Our mind then remembers that drinking alcohol brings about the ease and comfort that we seek. We conveniently forget about the trouble that alcohol causes us. When we take the first drink and then trigger the physical craving for more and more alcohol, we have a spiritual malady, an obsession of the mind, and an abnormal reaction of body or an allergy to alcohol. This dooms us to an alcoholic death, spiritually, mentally, and even sometimes physically. There is additional material within these 51 pages from the doctor's opinion through to the end of chapter 3 called More About Alcoholism that further explain the physical, mental, spiritual aspects of alcoholism and how our lives can become unmanageable whether we are drinking or not. If you need more proof, please read on. All we've done is provide you with some of the highlights. However, we hope we've shown you enough for you to proceed. By way of review, let me describe what the big book says about step one and what differentiates an alcoholic physically, mentally, and spiritually from a non-alcoholic. And again, ask yourself if you can relate to the experience of an alcoholic. Physically, an alcoholic has an allergy or an abnormal reaction to alcohol. This abnormal reaction to alcohol is a craving for more alcohol once we take a few drinks. This craving never happens to a non-alcoholic. Because of this, a non-alcoholic can always predict how much they're going to drink, but an alcoholic cannot always predict how much they're going to drink. Besides the craving, alcohol does something for an alcoholic that it does not do for a non-alcoholic. When an alcoholic drinks, they get a feeling of ease and comfort and in control. Get up and go into town. I like this kind of a feeling. When a non-alcoholic drinks alcohol, they get an out of control, beginning of a nauseating, slightly tipsy, I don't like this, so I don't want any more kind of a feeling. That's why they stop after one or two and make statements like, I don't want another drink because I'm feeling the first one. Spiritually, because of the selfish, self-centered way the alcoholic views and deals with other people, their emotions, and life, they are filled with inner turmoil, discomfort, and anxiety. Since alcohol is the only thing that we have experienced which brings relief for this inner unmanageability, we turn to alcohol again and again, even though it has caused problems for us in the past. We don't see what alcohol is doing to us. We only think about what it's going to do for us, which describes the mental obsession. A non-alcoholic's relationship with alcohol is a take-it-or-leave-it kind of relationship, but an alcoholic's relationship to alcohol is I-need-it-to-deal-with-life kind of a relationship. Please ask yourself if you can relate to this to the experience of an alcoholic. Also, in the middle of the first paragraph on page 44 in your big book, makes a few statements that could be used to review the information about step one and the direction we need to move in. In the middle of the first paragraph on page 44, it says the following. If, when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, which describes the mental and spiritual aspects of alcoholism. Or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, which describes the physical part of alcoholism, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
Now it's time for each of us to start our personal journey towards that spiritual experience which will change our lives. Let's see who's ready to take the first step. The first step goes like this. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. The big book authors tell us exactly what we have to do by providing us with two statements that can be turned into questions. The first one can be found in the middle of page 30 of your books. We learned that we had to fully concede or admit to our innermost self that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion or lie that we are like other people or presently may be has to be smashed. In order to smash the delusion or the lie that we are not alcoholics, we are going to ask each of you to answer a simple question. Are you ready to concede or admit to your innermost self that you are powerless over alcohol? In other words, are you an alcoholic? All that's required is a yes or no answer. If you're not convinced you're alcoholic or that your life is unmanageable, please let us know later at the end of the session. Your sponsor or spiritual advisor is willing to spend time with you this week to discuss your reservations. You may not be an alcoholic. We want to give you every opportunity to comprehend the devastating consequences of this terrible affliction and help you identify if you are an alcoholic. There is another question associated with taking step one. That can be found on page 33 at the end of paragraph one. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, nor any lurking notion that someday we will be immune to or not affected by alcohol.
Okay, for those who are ready, let's proceed. Will the newcomers and those willing to work the steps with us during these next 5 weeks please stand? After hearing the review we just did, and ask yourself if you can relate to the experience of the alcoholic, here are two questions related to taking step one. Do you have no reservation or lingering idea that one day you will be unaffected by drinking alcohol? And do you concede or admit to your innermost self that you are an alcoholic? Please answer one at a time, perhaps starting from my left, yes or no. For those of you who have answered yes, you have reached the conclusion of step one. Please remember to talk with your temporary sponsor, a step sponsor, after this meeting to swap phone numbers and get to know each other. Also, over the next week, please read the handouts we provided for you. And if you notice in your handout, basically it starts with where the steps can be found in the big book. And it also, we're going to close with this step one prayer. It has an article about the circle and triangle. It has an article about the phenomenon of craving, just to give you a little bit more scientific information about it. It talks about an article that talks about the alcohol doesn't cook off. Ordering food cooked with alcohol could be very dangerous. And then it has the infamous step one unmanageability exercise, which you can see is two pages. It's about 15 paragraphs of questions that we'd like to ask you to fill out over the next week to just see how well you're doing spiritually. And then a three-page article about where these beginner classes came from. So, these handouts will enhance the experience of the step that we have just covered. Next week, we will discuss steps 2, 3, and the beginning of step 4. We will take the third step during the meeting, and we will begin to provide you with the guidelines for how to take a fourth step. You will be given 3 weeks to complete your fourth step inventory, and then please share your fifth step with your sponsor or spiritual advisor between session 4 and 5. In about an hour and a half, we have just covered over 50 pages worth of material in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and have taken step one. This is a remarkable achievement. Congratulations. Please keep in mind that these sessions are not about teaching and learning. In other words, this is not about sharing the information only. And we are not here to help you sound better at meetings. these sessions of our participating and having experience with the work and the rework of the 12 steps. Information without application is worthless. And I heard something recently I thought was funny, too. They said, inspiration without application is hallucination. Lena would like to close with, in your packet, it's on page 2. It's the step 1 prayer. And she's just going to read it, and maybe we can get quiet again and just be still and try to take in this prayer, because these actions are not self-help. These actions are starting from the beginning, asking our higher power to help us with this, and then being carried by that power through the process of the 12 steps. So this prayer helps us move in that direction. Yes? What question? Yeah, at the end. Yeah, definitely.
This prayer was written by one of our fellows from California. His name is Herb Kay, and it's a step 1 prayer to experience powerlessness. Please, God, bring me into this process and give me a new experience of powerlessness and unmanageability, as well as of your power and spirit. Make it clear that I'm fundamentally flawed in body and mind, as well as blocked spiritually. Also, please reveal that you're willing and will do for me what I can't do for myself. I want to surrender to you in this process, but I can't on my own power. You have taken me to a place of willingness, and I have been given the willingness to be taken. This is a gentle but definite process of awakening and awareness. I'm willing to be led by your spirit, to have truth revealed about me and about you. The requirement for this spiritual evolution is complete, unqualified surrender of myself or ego to you. On my own power, this cannot happen. Myself cannot submit. There is a quiet, gentle place where my willingness and your grace meet. I'm willing to surrender and pray that you take me to that place.